Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast. We're here at G2E 2025, the final day, and this is actually the final podcast of the session for me and for Dan Wallach, my guest. Dan is a gaming attorney from Miami, Florida area, and he's been involved in gaming for a long time, and recently he's become the leading expert on the predictions market and the sweepstakes casinos market. So let's start with the sweepstakes casinos, Dan. They seem to have taken a big hit recently.
Yeah, I mean, the big, I think what's starting to become known, to state regulators and just to the gaming industry is just the underlying business model,
right,
is based on a flawed premise, mm-hmm. right? The sweepstakes operators, they've gotten all these legal opinions from leading gaming law firms, mind you, saying that, they can operate a sweepstakes casino business as long as there's a free method of entry. And as long as a limited number of sweeps coins are made available by sending in a postcard or entering some social media contest and get like up to 5 sweeps coins, that somehow acts as an insulator around everything else. And I've done a deep dive on it and written 4 or 5 Forbes articles. And I discovered through my research that this is just like the internet sweepstakes cafe business model. And courts throughout the country have held that just because you offer a limited number of free sweepstakes entry, if it's gaming, if it's casino themed sweepstakes games, perpetually run, priced like you're buying the coins, one to one relationship, along with an RTP of between 90% and 96%. That's exactly how a casino business is run. So what I've tried to do is highlight how the underlying business model is illegal under just about every state's gambling law, and legislators around the country, lawmakers, state attorney generals are beginning to catch on to it.
So we've seen already a law in California banning sweepstakes casinos. I believe Arizona has one that's ready to go. How many other states are actually looking at it?
I think it's going to be incremental. We're at the end, near the end of the legislative sessions for 2025. There are only a couple more that are still meeting. But I believe that the successes this year, highlighted by major states like California, New York, and then the enforcement efforts led by several states, like Louisiana in particular, I think that's going to create some momentum. And just as we saw with sports betting laws and daily fantasy sports laws, there becomes this momentum. And in year two, many of the states are going to use the California bill and the New York bill as a blueprint. And several states came close this year and had almost unanimous approval in the state and houses of their legislature, and for whatever reason they couldn't get it over the line. I think next year builds off the progress in year one, but I think the big story going forward isn't necessarily going to be legislative. It will be state attorney general and state civil enforcement actions to claw back ill-gotten gains. I think those have to be done in parallel.
Sure. So obviously, the operators of these sites could possibly, be involved with indictments and things of that nature, just because they're violating state law. What kind of risk do the suppliers have? People supply them with games and payment systems and those kind of things.
The Los Angeles City Attorney filed a lawsuit in state court against State.us, which is one of the prominent sweepstakes companies. They named they named up to about 10 suppliers, including Evolution, Hacksaw Gaming, two publicly traded suppliers which provide game content to the illegal sweepstakes businesses. The mere filing of that lawsuit caused Hacksaw and Evolution to exit the California sweepstakes market, and in some cases, I think it might have even been Playtech, they got out of the U.S. sweepstakes market entirely. So the value of civil enforcement actions is that while legislative bans are helpful, these companies will come up with some innovation to sort of circumvent statutory definitions. So you need to keep the heat on, and I think the choke point for the sweepstakes casino operators, many of which are offshore, are the suppliers, many of which are publicly traded and face regulatory risk, reputational risk, decline in their stock price. The payment processors are also the weak link. And going forward, I think the most effective way of tackling the growth of sweepstakes casino gaming is through a combination of legislative enactments, state attorney general formal legal opinions and state civil enforcement actions to get restitution, disgorgement, injunctive relief to shut down these businesses. Legislation alone, all that does is redeploy assets to other states and in many cases come up with a new business model to circumvent the ban within a particular state. So you really do need the state attorney generals to get involved through opinions and legal proceedings.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be a long road to actually get rid of them. But they're here now. They're still operating in most states. So you think the states themselves have to make this action rather than the federal government?
Yeah, I mean, it's a slow process. The education began a year ago at G2E in 2024, right. And 1 year later, it's been significant progress.
Yeah.
Six states have enacted bans. One state, Louisiana, has issued a formal legal opinion declaring sweepstakes casino online businesses to be violative of state law. The Louisiana Department of Revenue, this is a new tactic, sort of the Al Capone tactic of going after filing lawsuits on behalf of the State Department of Revenue against VGW and one of the other major operators for unpaid sales and use taxes, right. Because when they're selling their digital coins online to Louisiana residents, two things they're not doing are paying sales taxes on it or registering as an entity that would be paying taxes. So one creative way that Louisiana has enforced its state ban, or at least its attorney general opinion, is to file litigation to claw back unpaid sales tax revenues. And the amount in controversy here is $44 million just against two companies. So a combination of tax revenue lawsuits, as well as disgorgement, restitution, and civil penalty type proceedings like the one that this Los Angeles City Attorney has filed, I think that might be the most effective, efficient, and expedient way of tackling the growth and curbing the growth of the online sweepstakes casinos. You have a multitude of states filing civil enforcement actions to claw back the gains. It will disappear. They don't have a defense. 10-plus states have issued well over 100 cease and desist orders based on alleged violations of state law. None of those have been challenged in court by any of the sweepstakes operators. And why? It's because they know they can't win a case. If the sweepstakes operators are sued by the state attorney general, it's low-hanging fruit for the state.
Yeah.
They'll be able to settle these cases for seven figures, eight figures, not maybe even nine figures, and ultimately win out.
Yeah.
There's no arbitration clause that frequently, the type of arbitration language that might preclude class action lawsuits.
Right.
The state attorney generals have no impediments in their way, and they can go directly after these sweepstakes operators. So I'm looking for that to be the next phase of enforcement against the illegal sweepstakes casinos.
Okay. And sweepstakes operators have no KYC, very little KYC. They copy responsible gaming practices from other legal sites, just put it up there. They're really not helping anybody.
They also allow 18 and over
in many
cases, and these safeguards are basically self-regulation.
Yeah.
Some of them are check the box.
Right.
I remember reading a Washington Post story about a year ago in which the KYC consisted of a testing by checking a box that you're 18 years of age or older without any corresponding ID requirement or driver's license or credit card. It was a superficial type of KYC requirement. So these sites have a threadbare amount of consumer protections, and certainly some of the larger ones are trying to correct that situation.
Sure.
But with 60 some odd sites in operation, many of them, which are located beyond U.S. jurisdictional borders, don't have anything approximating a robust KYC framework.
Sure, sure. Let's move on to prediction market. This is a much more complicated story because it already is federally regulated.
Lightly to non-existent.
That's true, but the language is there, correct?
Yeah.
and so states supposedly don't have a role in this, but they are filing. Well, you tell me. How are states reacting?
Well, the notion, or Kalshi, which has been the pioneer of these sports betting event contracts, their whole premise for legality is based on the fact that the Commodity Exchange Act grants the CFTC, which is the federal agency, exclusive jurisdiction over swap contracts, and swaps are defined so broadly to include any kind of contingency or occurrence that has potential economic or commercial consequences. And their position is, well, if you bet on a sporting event like the Super Bowl, Kentucky Derby, the Masters, there are economic consequences in the sense of television ratings, ad revenues, sponsorship dollars, the team valuations. But all that is built on a flawed premise, because when this regime was enacted by Congress in 2010, they weren't thinking about sports betting.
Sure.
At that time, and you've been in the gaming industry for quite a long time, the Wire Act was on the books. PASPA was on the books. Those two federal laws basically created a guardrail against any expansion of sports gambling across state lines. Those are the laws that represented congressional policy at the time. So in order to overcome that, I think Congress would need to speak very forcefully and explicitly that their desire with the Commodity Exchange Act was to create a national sports gambling framework. And they didn't do that explicitly. It's just implicitly or tacitly read into it by Kalshi through clever wordsmithing. But in an area such as gambling, which is traditionally regulated by the states, the courts have historically recognized a strong presumption against preemption. And in order for the federal law to overcome that, it has to be crystal clear,
right,
explicit in the statute, that that's what the design of the federal law is, to displace state sports gambling laws as to this particular product. And that kind of voice and that kind of intent is missing from the federal law, while at the same time, you have two other federal laws that clearly evince a strong federal policy of disfavoring sports gambling.
Right.
So the courts have been divided on the outcome so far.
Right.
The Maryland federal court, I think, has analyzed the legal issue precisely how it should be done, which is to look at gambling as traditionally a state prerogative,
right,
and to apply the presumption against preemption, which is based on U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence, and put the burden on Kalshi to demonstrate how the federal law clearly, explicitly, and manifestly overrides that congressional intent with clear language. So courts that apply that analytical framework, the states are going to win time and time again. The courts that focus on the definition of a swap, because it's so open-ended, that's a legal test that may be more favorable for Kalshi, and Kalshi, in fact, has won a couple of cases based on the loose definition of a swap. But the tide seems to be turning, because last week in Nevada, where we're currently having our conversation, the chief judge of the Nevada Federal District Court, Andrew Gordon, reversed course. And in a case filed by Crypto.com, Judge Gordon denied Crypto.com's preliminary injunction motion against Nevada, the state of Nevada, and held that their sports contracts that are tied to the outcomes of sporting events do not qualify as swaps under the CEA. And that decision could be very pivotal going forward, because it could lead to the Nevada cases being resolved in the state's favor, and it could have a carryover effect in other states now that Massachusetts and Ohio, Maryland, all these other states now have this turning of the tide and precedent to base their decisions on. So if the analysis is really going to be based on Congress's intent, the states win, the tribes win. If the analysis is based on whether it meets the test of a swap, well, now we have cases that go both ways, and that could still favor the states and the tribes. And with respect to tribal lawsuits, they're not even arguing state law. The Native American tribes are saying this is a violation of IGRA, the Federal Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, and that the availability of these sports event contracts over the internet while a customer is located on Indian lands violates tribes' sovereignty, and exclusivity under their state tribal compacts. And I believe that's an easier case for the tribes than the state versus federal preemption argument is for the states. And if the California tribes, which are having their case heard on October 23rd in San Francisco, prevail on that issue, it could be the further unraveling of Cauchy's legal argument. Sure. And while they started strongly, I think the momentum is now swinging heavily in favor of the states, largely due to the participation of the Native American tribes through their amicus curiae briefs and direct lawsuits, as well as better lawyering by the states.
Sure, right. No question about that. So recently, I signed up for Cauchy just to see what it was like. I was in there embedding in like 2 minutes.
Uh-huh.
It took me at least half an hour on a legal sports betting platform. So obviously their KYC is lacking as well.
Or they could have very effective KYC if they wanted to have it. But I think your take on it is probably more accurate. Listen, they designed this for those 18 years of age and over. They don't have the KYC that online sports betting companies have. They're not licensed. While they're licensed as a designated contract market by the CFTC, the CFTC does not regulate or does not have any rules or regulations that are specific to gambling or specific to sporting events. This is an antiquated regulatory regime that is name only. And one of the concerns that the sports leagues have is that there's no information sharing or integrity monitoring.
Sure.
They have absolutely, the NBA and the NFL and Major League Baseball have no idea what's going on because these platforms are under no obligation to share information with them. And ironically, the leagues have always been in favor of federal regulation.
Right.
But this type of federal regulation is infinitely more patchwork and deficient than the worst state-level regulation. And the states have done a much more effective job of using their robust licensing framework, mandatory integrity monitoring, information sharing. Yeah, it's a little clunky sometimes to go across state lines, and maybe its information isn't shared as quickly as it would be in real time with a unified platform.
Right.
But none of this is happening federally on the CFTC.
Right.
They only have one commissioner. They have 25% less staff than they did a year ago because of all of the Trump and Elon Musk job cuts.
Right.
They are incapable of regulating something as sophisticated as, I wouldn't say it's more sophisticated than commodities, but it's a different type of product that the CFTC is ill-suited to regulate and does not have the current bandwidth or rulemaking capacity to regulate.
Right. Let's talk about the CFTC. Like you mentioned, there's just one commissioner. Supposedly, one of the top officials of Cauchy was supposed to be named chairman. Trump pulled him back. What's going on at the CFTC now? Can they actually be built to be robust enough to
it's going to take a while. With one commissioner, I doubt there's any bandwidth or legal authority to engage in the rulemaking process to provide some guardrails around sports contracts. They're basically handicapped by virtue of the fact that they don't have sufficient staff and are only acting with one commissioner. Now, the palace intrigue over whether Brian Quintenz, why he was removed, there are some other issues in play there, and I think it might be a turf battle between the current interim chairperson Caroline Pham, maybe trying to undercut. I have no idea what's going on, but there's some suggestions that there are a lot of battles between former and current commissioners, and Donald Trump is allowing this to basically play out without moving forward and providing any definitive, CFTC chairperson. So it's a shit show right now at the federal government level. You have an agency that can't regulate, isn't in a position to regulate, doesn't have enough regulatory bandwidth to regulate, no staff, and almost a year into Trump's presidency, they'll be naming their first CFTC chairman. This is not the kind of regulatory robust framework potential that could alleviate any concerns about integrity issues or consumer protections. They regulate commodities. They have no expertise for sports betting. Now, can they develop that expertise over time? Yes, but they basically shot first and ask questions later. You have a bunch of platforms that are operating right now without any guardrails. They can self-serve. certify any kind of event contract they want, prop bets, who has the most touchdowns, parlays, and pretty soon casino contracts.
Right.
The CFTC has a regulation intact right now, a regulation on the books, Rule 40.11A1, which prohibits the listing or trading of event contracts that involve gambling.
Yeah.
So you have an agency
right.
that shouldn't even be allowing this,
right.
yet is not enforcing its existing regulatory prohibition. And I think the failure to apply or enforce its own law is really contrary to the public interest.
Sure.
And maybe that's an argument that could maybe turn the tide in favor of the states in some of these lawsuits, because Calci is asking for a preliminary injunction.
Right.
And one of the factors on a motion for a preliminary injunction is you have to demonstrate that granting an injunction in favor of Calci would be in the public interest. And nothing can be more contrary to the public interest than when the regulator overseeing Calci refuses to follow its own law. And that's a serious public interest violation. It could potentially tip the scales in the state's favor. So I'm not very optimistic about federal law or a federal agency like this being able to effectively regulate sports gambling anywhere in the same ballpark, to use a sports metaphor, as the state-by-state regime is currently operating. It's like night and day, and if I was the NBA, Major League Baseball, or NFL, or NHL, I'd be petrified about having the goodwill of my product in the volatile hands of Calci, Polymarket, Crypto.com, with a non-existent regulator and a non-existent sports integrity framework. It is a recipe for disaster. And if the leagues truly want a federal framework, this might be a gateway towards getting there.
Yeah.
But it's going to be a really bumpy ride along the way, and it could be permanently detrimental to their brands if any scandals erupt through these sports prediction markets.
Sure. So the CFTC has been reluctant to talk about the sports betting aspect of their sports investment aspect, I guess they want to call it, of their company. And I found it strange that you said Trump is letting this play out while his son is on one of the advisors for Calci.
To accuse the CFTC of being regulatorily captured
right.
is not an accusation, it's a fact.
Right.
Prior to Trump becoming president, the CFTC had consistently enforced its regulatory ban against gambling.
Right.
Other entities that tried to be designated contract markets had listed contracts for sporting events, and the CFTC rejected them, stayed them. Applications were withdrawn when the staff indicated that they were going to lose, that the DCM proponent, I think RSVIX was one of the applicants. It has been consistently enforced by the CFTC. The moment Donald Trump becomes president, Donald Trump Jr. becomes a strategic advisor to Calci. And 3 days into Trump's presidency, only 3 days in, Calci filed its self-certification. And what did the CFTC under Trump do? Nothing. It was a quick 180-degree pivot from enforcing Rule 40.11A1 to now closing your eyes, covering your ears, and burying your head in the sand and not taking any action against these companies. And with Donald Trump Jr. being the strategic advisor to Polymarket and Calci, do you really think he's getting lunch money or an honorarium for his service as a strategic advisor? He's getting stock.
Yeah. Sure.
And one of the first discovery requests that I would propound if I was Nevada or any of these other states in litigation, I would want to know the business relationship and the compensation that Calci is paying to Donald Trump Jr. I know that they were giving Brian Quinten stock,
right.
and he was poised to become the CFTC chairman.
Right.
So I don't think it's a major leap to assume that the Trump family, through Donald Trump Jr., has an economic stake in the fortunes of both Polymarket and Calci, and the success of the company, and the continuation of these sports betting contracts, while these online sports betting operators, too scared to jump in, are going to basically create a path to dominance for Calci, and Polymarket and the Trump family will be enriched by not just tens of millions or hundreds of millions, but depending on the stock holdings, this could be the biggest scandal if any major media publication really wanted to take a deep dive. But that's why the CFTC, I suspect, I mean, it's my opinion, but just follow the money, follow the relationships, look at the timeline. And it paints a very clear picture of a regulatory capture.
Let's move on to...
Now that I'll get sued, but okay.
Well, you know, we'll see what happens there. I mean, when do you think there's going to be some sort of resolution one way or the other?
I think we're looking at probably 1 to 2 years, maybe 3 years. At the Supreme Court, we could be looking 27, 28.
Yeah.
But that doesn't foreclose the possibility of individual states
winning
their lawsuits and Cauchy losing emergency motions to stay enforcement of those rulings. Because if they lose in Massachusetts, if they lose in Ohio, if they lose to the tribes, Cauchy's filing of an appeal is not enough to prevent the states or the tribes from enforcing their victories. Cauchy also, in turn, with the filing of a notice of appeal, has to ask the appellate courts for an emergency stay pending appeal. So if they lose those emergency stay motions at both the trial court, Court of Appeals, and at the U.S. Supreme Court, that could happen in rapid-fire succession within, let's say, 90 days.
Right.
It's quite possible that in some states or in certain tribal reservations that by the end of the first quarter 2026, Cauchy may have to pull its contracts and exclude residents from those states and from those tribal reservations. So there is an outside chance that Cauchy will have less than 50 state reach if Massachusetts or a few other states, Nevada goes in its favor. It's not going to ultimately turn initially, or it's not going to initially turn on the how long the appeals will last.
Sure.
The battleground for geofencing or not geofencing may very well be the emergency motion practice following Cauchy's defeat in the trial court, because they're going to need the appellate courts to grant it a stay in order to enable it to pursue its further appellate rights. So they could take this all the way to the Supreme Court of Mars, but without an emergency stay from the U.S. Court of Appeals, the state Supreme Court, or the U.S. Supreme Court, they're going to have to geofence.
Yeah.
And while Maryland was willing to consent to a stay pending further appellate review, I think the next time a state beats Cauchy, or the next time a tribe beats Cauchy, they're going to go for the jugular and not give any quarter and try to get a court to persuade a court to deny Cauchy's motion for a stay. So Massachusetts wants Cauchy out of Massachusetts. So how long will this take? I think ultimately, with finality, all 50 states, probably looking at 2027, 2028, but in the interim, there may be a couple of states that Cauchy pulls out of following losses across the board, including on stay motions. And then the remainder will depend on how the federal courts of appeal rule. If all the federal courts of appeal rule the same way, whether it's in the state's favor or Cauchy's favor, I would think the Supreme Court would be reluctant to take the case. If, however, there is a split among the circuits, and it appears to me that that is the greater likelihood, I think the Supreme Court intervention in this will be 2027, with a likely decision that year or in the first half of 2028. So at the outer limit, this controversy can last 2 to 3 more years, with potentially states picking up quick victories early on and being able to enforce their state laws in limited situations. But even if the courts decide this issue, the wild card is Congress.
Right, sure.
Because while the courts can debate the issue of congressional intent, Congress can close the loop on that issue and clarify its congressional intent by amending its existing definition of a swap to include sports contracts. So if the Trump administration, which has so much tied into these prediction markets, both financially and now you see institutional money, ICE, you know, the owner of the New York Stock Exchange, all these big wheels and major financial institutions have a vested interest in the success of the sports prediction markets. And that tells me that they're not going to sit tightly if this all goes away.
Right.
So the backup plan is going to be Congress. The question is, will the backup plan be implemented in time before the midterm elections potentially swing congressional control at least partially back in the Democrats' favor.
Well, Dan, thanks for taking the time to join us.
I did this without coffee. You should always get me after caffeine. I'll do an even better job. But I think I carried myself, acquitted myself admirably.
You did a great job.
Unless you're Cal Sheet. I didn't do a good job if you're Cal Sheet.
Well, everybody appreciates what you're doing and bringing to light some of these court cases that nobody would ordinarily hear about. People should follow you on LinkedIn if you want to follow this really interesting story. And we want to thank you for putting that up and talking to us.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you for having me on. The greatest compliment anyone ever paid me was Steve Ruddick, who didn't name me as the most influential person in the prediction market space, but he called me the most opinionated attorney on the topic. And I'm not afraid to give my view on which way I think things will turn out or should turn out. And I think I combine the legal acumen, the news gathering, news breaking, as well as, you know, my take on it, which is not designed to be neutral. I'm telling you how I feel. And clearly, I think the states have the better of the legal arguments on both sweepstakes and on prediction markets. And hopefully, I expect to be proven right, but I won't stop. I mean, I'm enjoying this. And I think it's important for that voice to be heard and for people to not assume that prediction markets operating in perpetuity is something that's inevitable. Yeah. The courts will decide this issue and then potentially Congress. But without a court victories, without a congressional enactment, the prediction markets may not be here for long, at least with respect to sports.
Well, Dan, thanks for coming by. I really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you later.